Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan Political Podcast. When it comes to the Republican primary for Michigan's U.S. Senate race, candidate Mike Rogers, a past chair of the U.S. House Intelligence Committee, says this thing is done. The share of likely GOP primary voters supporting Rogers grows from 27% to 67% after they learn he is backed by past President Donald Trump, according to one March survey. MERS is also joined by Executive Director Cheryl Bergman of the Michigan Women's Commission. She discusses the latest report on women in Michigan's labor force, which found that women working full-time earned around 81 cents on the dollar compared to men in 2022. State Representative Bill G. Schuette, a Midland Republican, describes how, as the latest chair of the House Republican Campaign Committee, he projects Republicans will win north of 56 seats in the state house in November. In 2022, Democrats won a 56-seat majority in the House. Now, here's MERS podcast host Samantha Schreiber, MERS editor Kyle Malin, publisher and the boss John Roerink, and for the second segment, administrative reporter Andrew Miniker.
Thank you so much, Mark Bayshore, for warming up today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. For this week's edition, we are launching things with an interview with the Republican U.S. Senate candidate Mike Rogers, who previously was a Livingston County member of the U.S. House from 2001 through 2014, serving as chair of the House Intelligence Committee during his time in Congress. He has also served in the U.S. Army as a special agent in the FBI, and before entering the U.S. House, he represented Clinton, Livingston, and Shiawassee counties in the state Senate. Recently, on March 11th, Mike Rogers received the, quote, complete and total endorsement, end quote, of past President Donald Trump, who's currently running to win back the White House in November. Hey, Mike, how are you doing today?
I am doing great, Sam. Thanks for having me.
No, well, thank you so much for joining us. So to begin our conversation, I want to know about your journey of supporting the past president. You received some criticism earlier this year for endorsing Trump after you were first introduced in this race as wanting to be outside of what you called sugar high politics, which are often affiliated with the Trump brand. Why did your rhetoric around the former president change?
Well, I'm not sure the rhetoric around the issues around the president changed. Matter of fact, it didn't at all. So the same issue set that concerns every Michigan family is exactly the same. And, you know, primaries are things where you discuss differences amongst your family, and general elections is where you discuss differences with the other party. And we certainly progressed to understanding that we were getting around the issues and getting closer to being interested in talking about what the other party's doing wrong for the state of Michigan and Michigan families. So, I mean, this happens 1,000 times a day all across America. I just think, you know, because it's Donald Trump, it takes on a different level. But I've had good conversations with President Trump about the kinds of things that are important, about stopping the border, about the crime wave that's coming because of the open border, both a national security front and a criminal drug cartel front. I mean, they are getting rich and wealthy and showing up in our neighborhoods, and about the cost of groceries. I say often that the most expensive vehicle to operate in 2024 because of Biden policies is your shopping cart. And so we talked about all of those things and how we could do some things right away to get things done. And so when you look at the two choices, it's either Biden for another 4 years or Trump for another 4 years. It's pretty easy decision, I think. And that's why you see Trump is ahead even across the state of Michigan today, which is just unheard of. I mean, he's up by 8 points. He wasn't up by 8 points in 2016.
Hey, Mike, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what was involved in securing the endorsement of the president. Did you have to go down to Florida? Where did you meet him?
Did not go down to Florida. We just had several conversations, tended to be phone conversations. We had one in-person meeting when he was here in Michigan. And that's, you know, we just talked, they were very substantive-based conversations. And the president's going to play here in Michigan. And he understands that it helps him, like he helps the candidate, by building out an infrastructure that's going to win around the state. And, you know, that's the non-sexy, not often reported things about an election that really matter, about a ground game, about, you know, ballot integrity, about voter contact, about ballot chasing, all of those things that campaigns engage in are what's going to make a difference in November. And we have, you know, our campaign, Rogers for Senate, has already started all of that. I think that was also an important factor in this endorsement. We are going to build out a statewide campaign, and we've already started, where a lot of the other folks in the primary have, you know, talked about a primary only approach. And that just isn't going to cut it. You can't win in November with that kind of approach. And I think the president saw how we lined up on issues, saw how we were putting together a statewide campaign, and he believes that we're going to win. And he believes we are someone he can work with in the United States Senate and get things done right away. Think about it. I don't have no on the job training for me. I can walk right into the Senate and get busy.
Mike, I don't know if you saw our poll that we did with Mitchell Research last week, but after Republican primary voters were told that Donald Trump has endorsed you, your percentage of support went from 27% to 67% support. Does that signal that maybe this is going to be a mutually beneficial agreement here where Donald Trump gets help in Michigan with this infrastructure you're talking about, with the money that you're likely going to be able to spend in your campaign, while also you get kind of that Trump brand and are able to connect with voters in that way?
I mean, there was a poll that had us up 60 points over our opponents. Is that what you're telling me? Shocking.
It had you at 67% after the people were told that Trump had your endorsement.
Yeah, I did. I may have seen that poll, but you know, the other part of that is that puts us over 60 points ahead of the nearest primary opponent. I mean, this thing is done. And, you know, any kicking, screaming, biting, throwing rocks isn't going to change that. And what it does do, because you get that much of a bump on this, for all the reasons we just talked about, why it was important, I think, for President Trump to actually endorse a candidate that is A, aligned on the issue sets, and B, has the ability to put together an infrastructure. Yeah, I think all of that was really, really important. And it allows to get to that sooner. I mean, candidly, the sooner that this thing gets put to bed, the primary, the more effort we can put into beating the Democrat nominee in the fall. And that's what really this is. This is all about trying to win the state for a Republican, not necessarily, you know, a tough and ugly primary fight.
You zoomed in on the issue of immigration early in our conversation, but right now you're seeing Republicans in Congress pick up some criticism, right? Like, are they holding the immigration issue politically hostage to be used as an election year goodie? Do you share those same concerns?
No, I read that bill that the Democrats said was the catch-all. There were a few good things in there, but it made permanent an illegal immigrant stream into the United States. And so you have to remember, the cartels are now running the show on the southern border. You saw where they were, you know, these 20 to 30 year old males stormed the fences, were taunting our border patrol folks. Trust me, as a former FBI guy, worked organized crime. These aren't people who are economic refugees. Those are likely criminals who have engaged in criminal behavior in the past. You don't want to make that permanent. The president of the United States were serious, Joe Biden, about securing the border. He would implement a Remain in Mexico policy yesterday. You have to stop the incentives for these people to get up there and get in. That would be number one. Number two, all of these municipalities need to stop offering things that even their own citizens don't get, debit cards and phones and room and board at nice hotels. All of that stuff needs to stop. And what that bill did is it didn't correct any of the problems, and there was no enforcement mechanism in that bill. My argument is that's where the danger comes in. You have got to control our southern border. You got to turn it off. And here's the problem. Even if we turn off the border tomorrow, these gang cartels are operating in the United States almost with impunity. That Venezuelan gang that was founded in prison, operating in New York, now they're in Chicago, they're in Miami. They are also trying to organize, I've seen reports, other criminal gangs, other cartel gangs. The Chileans, who are operating in Michigan, by the way, and we see that apparently the sheriff in Oakland County was saying recently that the Colombian gangs are now showing up, which tend to be a little bit more violent, are operating in southeast Michigan, doing what criminal cartel gangs do. They break into houses, home invasions, those kinds of things. It's all happening. And so we have all of these big, huge problems looming because of this. And then, of course, you saw the on the national security front, a Hamas operative crossed the southern border. They caught him building a bomb to take to New York City. I mean, when the FBI says everything is blinking red, and it's not if, it's when we have an attack, that tells you something's wrong. None of that was fixed with those bills. They really have got to be serious about this.
Well, Mike, I wanted to ask you about this criticism that you'll probably be getting regarding Benghazi and the report that you did that arguably didn't reflect what the contractor saw on the ground, and that had some cover up for what Hillary Clinton and the Obama State Department found out. How are you going to be responding to those types of critiques?
Well, first of all, that's absolutely factually incorrect. So my timeline, so there were several different investigations. One was an intelligence. One was from in the State Department or Foreign Affairs. Congressman Royce did that one. And then there was a DOD one that happened as well, a guy named McKeon, Congressman McKeon. So each did their own lane. All of my timelines were used in the Benghazi, the broader Benghazi investigation, even at the end of the day. There was no determination different in the Benghazi, the grander select committee on Benghazi, than what I found in mine. A lot of that was nonsense and conspiracy theory early on. And what do they say? A lie goes around the world, you know, before the boots or the truth gets its boots on in the morning. That was exactly that. So the facts do not align with those stories. It's very, very easily refutable. People say things, they have no proof of it. You know, my argument is, if you're going to make those shots, then show me. Well, they can't, because my report, both the unclassified and classified report, were used to further the investigation in the Grand Benghazi Committee. And of course, I voted for the bigger Benghazi Committee because I fought the Foreign Affairs investigation and the Department of Defense investigation, areas I had no visibility in, weren't getting done properly. So I thought you needed to put it all in one place to actually see the whole picture. So it's just all nonsense. It was, I think, you know, people were trying to sell a book at the time, and, you know, God bless them. But it just didn't happen the way that they said back then. And so we're not finding any pushback today on it. I think people believe it. And again, you know, the final arbiter on that was Donald Trump's endorsement.
So as of right now, in the Mitchell survey that we reference, it shows that Alyssa Slotkin is doing better with independent voters than you. What is your game plan for winning independent voters from Alyssa Slotkin in a general election setting?
Yeah, and a lot of those independent voters just don't know who we are in and around the Southeast Michigan area. And so we're going to work on that. Our issues align, you know, 4-1 with independent voters. I mean, 4-1. And so we're going to have an opportunity to talk to them about issues that matter. They align with us on the border. They align with us on cost of goods and services. They align with us on the EV mandates. They align with us on crime. And we have, here's the good news, solutions on all of it. It isn't just pointing out that there's a problem. We have solutions on all of it. And we're going to be very aggressive on a literacy effort on our campaign that we know independents are pretty fired up about trying to fix that problem. We have a huge problem in America, not only from a business community hiring perspective, but getting the right kind of people to join our military. One of the big reasons people can't join the military is they don't read well enough to pass the test. So we're going to try. We have a solution to fix all of those things. And once once we engage with that community, they are absolutely aligned with where we're at. And so that's just a matter of time. I mean, remember, she has spent $30 million in the last three election cycles telling people who she was. We haven't spent a dime, and we're tied. If I were the Democrats, I'd be a little worried about that.
Everybody, that is Republican U.S. Senate candidate Mike Rogers. Thank you so much for joining us on the MERS Monday podcast.
Hey, thanks, everybody.
Joining us for our middle segment of the MERS Monday podcast is Cheryl Bergman, the Chief Executive Officer of the Michigan Women's Commission, or the MWC, which is a role she served in since September 2019. The state's Women's Commission was initially established in 1968 by statute and consists of 15 commissioners, all appointed by the governor to serve three-year terms. Cheryl is here with us, though, specifically to discuss the report put out this month on March 20th as a collaboration with the Michigan Center for Data and Analytics and the state's Department of Labor and Economic Opportunity. The report is titled Women in the Michigan Workforce. Its summary findings zoom in on how in Michigan, women 16 years old and over had a labor force participation rate of 57.3%, while the participation rate for men in the labor force in the state was 67.2%. Meanwhile, for women with children under the ages of five, their participation rate was more than 20 percentage points lower than their male counterparts. Hello, Cheryl. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for coming on. But to launch our discussion here, can you illustrate to our listeners what items in this report stood out most to you?
Well, we have a persistent pay gap, and this always stands out to me. There was a 2021 Women in the Michigan Workforce report, and the good news is that the pay gap then was 82 cents per dollar. So women working full-time year-round earn approximately 82 cents on the dollar for men in 2020. Now we are in 2022 with the 2024 report illustrates the 2022 data. We now earn approximately 81 cents per dollar that men earn. So that really sticks out is the persistent pay gap. Our labor force participation rates for women are below those of men in Michigan by 10%. There's a 10% gap. Women are participating at 57.3% and men at 67.2%. And, you know, we can attribute that to during the pandemic. So our 2021 report showed that 136,000 women had left the workforce entirely in 2020 during the pandemic, mainly due to caregiving responsibilities. And now we're looking at the labor force gap has closed considerably, but there's still about 2,000 women who've never reentered the workforce since the pandemic. And we're just a little slower to return to the workforce than men post-pandemic.
Just to confirm, what year does this report zoom in on?
2022 data.
Now, what are the dynamics at play here, would you say, at least anecdotally?
Well, it's childcare. It is, for the pay gap, it is, you know, these are the factors. It's childcare, affordable, accessible childcare. It is occupational segregation. Women are still underrepresented in some of the high, you know, STEM careers, which are the high wage earning opportunities. Even though women in Michigan hold 66% of women in Michigan hold degrees or certificates compared to 62% of men in Michigan. So we're more educated, but we still are mainly in the lower wage earning career. So occupational segregation, as well as the pay gap and attributes to the pay gap and childcare is a big issue.
So I'm wondering, what are some of the solutions to the equality that this report brings out?
Yeah. So, you know, for the pay gap, one thing that, so Governor Whitmer in 2019, immediately when she became governor, signed an executive directive that stopped state departments within Michigan from asking about or investigating an at job applicant's salary history. And I believe this when the governor says, if every employer did this one thing, the pay gap would close immensely. Now, there's other things that employers can do to help close the pay gap, like salary transparency as well, listing the salary ranges on job postings, et cetera. And then the other big thing is childcare. You know, we know that the anecdotally, at least, and with some data, that the women who left the workforce during the pandemic, 136,000 of us, was mainly due to the lack of childcare because childcare was closing, et cetera. And, you know, Governor Whitmer has invested a lot in childcare. And one of the things that we, the Women's Commission, are doing is we administered the pilot of the Michigan My TriShare Childcare program, which shares the cost equally between the employer, the employee, and the state of Michigan. We are now in the process of transitioning that TriShare program to the governor's new MyLEAP department, Lifelong Education Advancement and Potential, so it can live there and thrive there and go to scale statewide. So, and she's also passed $1.4 billion Caring for My Future package, which was to increase the capacity of childcare in the state. And they've already hit their 2024 goal and are going to keep going with creating 1,000 new childcare facilities and care providers in the state.
It seems that childcare is the big issue. Well, do I dare say the big issue, the major big issue? How do you describe it?
A very big issue. Yeah, if you look at the report, the labor force participation rate difference between men and women in Michigan is the biggest for women who have children under 5 in the household. And then it shrinks when you look at women who do not have children in the household, the labor force participation rate. And women are more likely to work part-time jobs than men, you'll see in the report. And that's because a lot of times we are, you know, shuffling between, I got to get the kids to school, I got to get the kids to daycare or childcare, excuse me. And, you know, I'm hustling between jobs because that's how I have the flexibility I need to make the money I need to support my family and to be able to care for my family as well.
I know one can say that childcare is something that is subjected to the ebbs and flows of supply and demand, if that is accurate, and that you have communities in Michigan where childcare is viewed as a scarce resource, rather it be a metro city or a rural community. I think a question I have is, like, what is going on right now when it comes to improving access to childcare? Because it almost seems like we're in a bit of this massive guinea pig experiment of throwing money, trying to offer these subsidies. But I mean, are you actually seeing growth
in the number of childcare providers? Yeah, absolutely. Like I mentioned, with the governor's Caring for My Future package, which I think was passed in 23, with FY23. That investment has created more than 1,000 new childcare providers in the state, licensed childcare providers, and/or expanded existing childcare facilities. But there still is a lack. And I got to tell you, one of the other things is, you know, that we don't, as a culture, we don't value caregiving. So, you know, one of the big challenges is getting childcare workers, because you don't make a living wage as a childcare worker. You barely make a living wage as a K-12 teacher in the country, in Michigan and in the country. So, you know, there needs to be, there's these, you know, women's occupations that are often mainly women, like teachers, like childcare workers, like even nursing. You know, we see a gap in pay. It's an artificial lower wage for women for caregiving occupations. And we need to focus on changing the culture around how we value caregiving, in my humble opinion.
So you mentioned culture, and it seems like the culture as well puts more onus on men going into STEM fields, which was another thing that you pointed out in the report. Now, how do you rectify getting that shifting that culture to get more women into the STEM fields?
If you look at the report, it also shows that of the people in Michiganders who are in registered apprenticeship programs in Michigan, only 10% of those are women. And of those 10%, they're in the lower wage earning apprenticeship programs, like the childcare, like physician's assistants, et cetera, not the skilled trades, not the IT programs. And when we saw that data about a year ago, the Women's Commission hit the road. We started a roundtable series, Pathway to High Wage Jobs. We kicked the first one off in November in Detroit at Accenture. The governor was there. One of our commissioners, Lisa Cawley, is the Accenture Michigan director of Accenture. And we highlighted their IT apprenticeship program, which is a registered apprenticeship program in Michigan, which after a year being paid in this apprenticeship program, 85% of the apprentices are hired into Accenture at very well-paid jobs. And Accenture has committed to 50% of their apprentices being women, which is really exciting. And they're encouraging other employers who have apprenticeship programs to do the same. The other thing, our next stop is at Consumers Energy in April. One of our commissioners, Tamara Faber, is a vice president at Consumers Energy. And we're going to focus on their skilled trades apprenticeship program and promoting skilled trades, obviously, to women. And those are great. You know, if you can get into a skilled trades apprenticeship program, and we encourage women, once you get into skilled trades and you get a union job, you're guaranteed equal pay with a union job. So those are strong. And I was just at the Women in Skilled Trades graduation. I don't know if you're familiar with the WISP program, but it's a pre-apprenticeship program for women in the skilled trades. And I was just at their graduation, and we're celebrating three journeymen, and they don't call them journey women. They call them journeymen because it's a title, accomplishment, not necessarily. I was like, do we call you journey women? And I'm like, nope, call us journeymen. And so it's happening, and they've graduated like 86 women now, and there's more and more and more women, but we're so underrepresented in the skilled trades, which lead to good, high paying union jobs where you don't have to worry about the pay gap.
I'm really curious about what are kind of some things going on in Michigan that are Michigan-specific barriers to women in the workforce. I know that those larger labor participation numbers for those 16 years and older, in Michigan, it's 57.3% for women, 67.2% for men. But then on the national, the U.S. average participation rates, it's 57.2% for women and 68.1% for men. I know that there's not really a big difference in those thresholds. So what is Michigan specific here?
You know, there's really not anything Michigan specific. This wage gap, labor participation gap, issues with childcare, all of it, it's a national issue. There's really nothing Michigan specific in this report.
Is there a state, though, that you think kind of holds the gold standard when it comes to making these markets more accessible for female participation?
You know, there are a few states like California, the state of Washington, Colorado, and I believe New York have all passed robust equal pay legislation. And it's like, for example, the wage gap. There's still a wage gap, even though they've done this, although they're new. So it's building, like it's just within the couple of years that they've all of these states have passed. So that's yet to be seen. But the pay gap is shrinking within those states because of this legislation. Like I think in California, the pay gap, women make 89 cents on the dollar for men, which is quite a significant difference between our 81 cents on the dollar for men.
Are there any policy proposals that deal with gender equity in the workplace, but are a little bit more complicated than what meets the eye?
That's a great question.
You know, I know paid family leave, that was a proposal that was circulating.
Yeah, but you're not. Huge.
Yeah, but I know that there are kind of some issues at play, too, trying to get a full understanding of how workers and employers view such a proposal. I don't know. Is there anything like that that kind of comes to your mind that maybe on the surface it seems like the perfect way to achieve what your commission might be aspiring, but could be a little bit more complex as you dive deeper into the weeds of getting that done?
Yeah, absolutely. And you bring up a great example with paid family leave. You know, the governor at the end of last year, I think it was in August, she gave her what next speech or report, and paid leave was one of the topics that she talked about, something she wanted to see done. And she still wants to see that done, but there's a delicate balance between the employers in the state and the, you know, how that in a policy like that looks to them and how it may affect their bottom line versus their, you know, need for retaining and attracting employees. And we need to marry those two things together. so that it works for employers and helps our workforce and closes those gaps. But paid leave, flexible schedules, remote work, pay, you know, closing the pay gap, affordable, accessible childcare, these are all issues. When we, so the mission of the Women's Commission by statute is that we survey the women of Michigan, identify challenges they face, and address the challenges that they, that we find by making policy recommendations. And we traveled around the state with the governor in late 19 when I started this job, and early 2020, right before the pandemic hit. And all of those things that I just mentioned were what were on the women's minds, all economic security issues, with affordable, accessible childcare at the top of the list. And that was before the pandemic hit and really shone a light on the challenges we face with childcare.
I know that there is some legislation dealing with female representation in corporate leadership positions. So, for example, I know Senator Santana had a bill that starting in 2026, a publicly held domestic or foreign corporation with Michigan-based principal executive offices would need to have at least 3 female directors on the board. In that, that is a bill. I don't think it's received a committee hearing. But do you think policy like that could possibly have a significant impact? What are your thoughts on that type of idea?
I personally do. I think that, you know, we watched California do the same thing. Gosh, I can't remember when they passed the legislation, but close to 10 years ago. And it's now, it's been tied up in the courts lately. And I think basically the same thing, a mandate of how many women publicly held companies must have on their corporate boards. And it's led to some lawsuits. And I think that mandate has actually been stalled because of lawsuits at this point. But it was working. It was working in California. The evidence was there that it was working. And I'm not sure what employers don't understand, but the data shows that having more women in your C-suites, in your leadership, and on your boards leads to more profits, leads to more diversity in your workforce, which leads to better ideas. And the data is there. It shows it works. We just need, again, it's that culture. It's the culture change. And sometimes I think, in my personal opinion, you got to use a stick in order to make some of the culture change that needs to happen. Give us a chance to prove. Let's see what really happens when we have more women on corporate boards and in C-suites.
Well, then you would have some individuals that would push back and say, well, maybe how we get to this end goal is to just stop talking about gender altogether, that I want you to view me as a working professional because of my resume, not because of my gender. What is kind of your response to that? Why do you think it is still so important that we're putting out reports that zoom in on the women demographic?
Because we still have so many inequities. You know, we have to, unfortunately, we still have to focus on gender and the pay gap and the workforce participation gap. They exist, and they exist for reasons, because women are the caregivers. We are predominantly the caregivers in our household. Even if you have a, you know, partner or spouse in your household, we bear the burden. And it's, you know, even with not just childcare, but elder care as well. You know, I'm in that sandwich generation where, you know, many of us are caring for younger children while also caring for our parents as well. So that's why these persist. We still need to focus on gender. I dream of the day that gender won't matter in the workforce and how we look at the workforce and workforce participation. But right now, we still have to focus on it and focus on solutions.
One thing that the report zooms in on that I found interesting is healthcare and social assistance. The report says, despite women making up 80% of the employment in the industry of healthcare and social assistance, women earned approximately 52% of what men earned. Why do you think that is, that these women-dominated industries, you still see that pay gap issue?
Mainly it's because of the positions in this industry that women are holding, and they are artificially underpaid positions. And you'll look at and I don't have the data at my fingertips, but if you look at the healthcare industry overall, it's the men who are the administrators and the leaders of the CEOs of the hospitals, et cetera, and the women are working in the, you know, nursing, et cetera, and those are just artificially lower paid positions.
Do you think there are women that are just not interested in those higher roles? Do you think it is a lack of access? I mean, why aren't they getting into those interview rooms?
It's the same reason why we don't have as many women in C-suites all across the board. There's a broken rung. So when women get entered into the, you know, job, into the industry at the same level as men, maybe right after college, few years in, maybe a woman needs to leave, she's going to have her first child, or she has to leave the workforce for a little while for those kind of things. And then we call that the broken rung, where then at that middle manager type position, men are promoted at a faster rate and women are left behind. And they're just not giving the same opportunities to interview for those top positions.
Everybody, that is Cheryl Bergman, the Chief Executive Officer of the Michigan Women's Commission, or the MWC. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to talk to us on the MERS Monday podcast and to discuss the Women in the Michigan Workforce March 2024 report.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Wrap up today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. We will be concluding things with a conversation with State Representative Bill Schuette, a Midland Republican who serves on the House Appropriations Committee and who is currently the minority vice chair of the House Appropriations Subcommittee overseeing the Departments of Insurance and Financial Services, or DIFS, and Licensing and Regulatory Affairs, LARA for short. He is with us today particularly to discuss him recently being tapped to serve as chair of the House Republican Campaign Committee, the HRCC, for the remainder of the 2023-24 election cycle, where in the fall, Republicans and Democrats in Michigan will be battling for a majority number of seats to control the state house. In the January campaign finance quarterly, lasting from October 21st through the end of 2023, the HRCC pulled in more than $1 million in contributions and walked away from the fundraising period with more than $4.17 million in cash on hand. Meanwhile, for the purpose of illustrating the competition right now, the Michigan House Democratic Fund, in the same time frame, not including late contribution reports, picked up $1.064 million in contributions and had $3.5 million left over on their balance sheet. Hello, Rep. Schuette. How are you doing today?
Hey, Sam. Thanks for having me on the podcast. I'm doing well, and I enjoy the opportunity to talk with you today.
So just to kind of kick off our conversation, what is something new that you think you bring to this role of HRCC chair?
You know, that's a good question. You know, I was fortunate enough to have worked hand in glove with Andrew, and he did such a great job getting our House Republican Campaign Committee off and rolling. And I think, you know, my perspective coming from as a freshman in the state house effort, I'll be able to continue our campaign, but also, you know, bring some good vigor to the effort as well. So I'm looking forward to continuing on our good fundraising and the march to 56 seats this November.
All right, so let's nerd out a little bit on the actual races and what are some of the top priorities going into the spring recess here. What districts are you kind of keying on right now that we need, or the Republicans need candidates, high quality candidates to run for the seats?
Yeah, Kyle. So I think it's important to realize, you know, just how close the 2022 election was, in the fact that there were seven seats that Republicans lost by less than 2,000 votes. And we're shaping up in an election year that's going to be much more competitive at the top of the ticket with a Joe Biden versus Donald Trump top of the ticket with the presidential race. And, you know, there are 10 seats that Donald Trump has carried between the 2016 and 2020 elections. So there'll definitely be a lot of different paths where Republicans can play in this next election.
So as far as the seats then that you're going to need to get candidates for, can you give us a couple? I know that there's at least one in Macomb County that I haven't seen a candidate for yet. So that may be on your list. The 61st is what I'm thinking of. Is there any others that you're kind of focusing on right now?
Yeah, you know, we have a finely tuned operation and recruitment machine with the House Republican Campaign Committee. We've, you know, Mike Harris and Jamie Green have been spearheading that effort. And by the time the dust settles on filing deadline, I know we'll have our seats fully fleshed out. But, you know, what I would say is, as far as specific seats, you can look, and I know MERS is one of the best handicappers in the business. Between 2016 and 2020, there's 10 seats that Trump carried at the top of the ticket. And then when you factor in the fact that for the last four cycles, the House Republicans have overperformed the top of the ticket, there's going to be a lot of opportunities for Republicans to go on offense and win in this next election.
I'm going to force you to do some name dropping. Which House Democrats do you think are the most vulnerable right now?
I think any House Democrat that is in the seat that Donald Trump carried in 2020 is very vulnerable, and 2016 is vulnerable as well.
You got to give us something more specific. Come on, do it for the newsletter.
you know, Sam, again, I think there's few outlets that are better at handicapping individual races than MERS. But I know our focus is on getting 56 seats. And there's a lot of different paths to victory from the seats that Donald Trump won in both 2016 and 2020. And I also know that when you're looking at how House Republicans have overperformed the top of the ticket, there's no shortage of seats. So if you're asking for specific names, I think the name who should be very nervous is Joe Tate, because, you know, Speaker Tate, I have a lot of respect for, but he won't be coming back as Speaker next term.
What vote do you think the House Democrats took this past term or this term that is going to come back to really bite them in this election?
Well, the good news is there's no shortage of those, Kyle. I think the one that plays very poorly across the state is the energy package that Democrats rammed through in the cold dead of night last November. Because, you know, it doesn't matter if I'm knocking on doors in my own district or if I'm downriver, you're in Macomb County, up in the UP, everybody is upset with the price of their heating bills, the price of their energy bills. And what Michigan Democrats did is just pass legislation that's only going to make those utility prices even more expensive. And then when you factor in the unpopularity of the wind and solar siting legislation, that is difficult. And that's problematic. But you know, there's plenty of other options as well. I think that downriver and in Macomb County, gun control is not popular. And in the country club Republican limousine liberal area of Traverse City, prevailing wage and right to work aren't popular. So the fact is, the Democrat caucus, Kyle, every single one of their members has the same voting record. You know, Jamie Churches and Abraham Ayash have the same voting record. You know, Betsy Kofia and Alabas Farhat have the same voting record. Members representing you know, from Ann Arbor to Marquette have the same voting record. And I think that means that there is not a differentiation. They all have to own the same progressive record.
You know, and that's not hyperbole either. I was taking a look at the voting record for the last 5 years for Nate Shannon, for example. And his first 4 years, he was among the most conservative on the Democratic side. He either had the seventh or one case, the second, eighth most conservative voting record among House Democrats. But this past year, everybody, because of what they had to do in order to get their policy through, everybody had very close to the same record. His progressive voting record was 94%, which, you know, historically is a way big outlier for him. But that's what everybody had to do in order to get their bills passed.
Yeah, no, every single member of the Democrat caucus has had to walk the plank for their far left progressive agenda. And that's problematic if you're Nate Shannon. You've been able to build a brand of being a moderate in previous elections, but now your caucus has had you literally go out on a limb on some of the most extreme policies that the Michigan Democrats passed. And that means in past cycles, members up in Marquette, members in Macomb or downriver have been able to style their own brand. They all have to own the extreme agenda of this Michigan Democrat trifecta.
What do you think is something that Republicans have gotten wrong in their recent past fundraising campaigning efforts?
I'm not sure if it's something that we've gotten wrong, but what I can tell you is something that, you know, Leader Hall has done really well is take our message across the state. And you've seen how effectively we've been able to fundraise from donors and a variety of sources from across our state, not just relying sort of on the Lansing lobby core. And, you know, there's good reason for that, because that's why the minority party has been able to have more cash on hand than the majority party. If you're just relying on the same old sources of funding, you know, money is going to follow the majority. But I think that's something our HRCC team has been able to do very well, is show those who are going to be hurt the most by the impact of these harmful policies and why a Republican agenda means a stronger Michigan.
What are your thoughts on how substantially more expensive it's gotten to run for a legislative office, especially a state house district?
Well, you know, Joe Biden's America, everything is more expensive, but that's, you know, partly just a cost of, you know, living factor that has gone up. But politics and campaigns are, everything's become more nationalized, everything's become more partisan. And that's just a fact of life. And that means we have to do the work, kind of like Sisyphus, fundraising money, you push the rock up the hill, you turn around and you keep pushing the rock up the hill.
I wanted to ask you about your feelings on the issues that the Republicans have used in the past that maybe to kind of mobilize its base, but may not be so popular now in 2024, right to life, for example, or liberalizing gun policy, or, you know, telling people that everybody should be allowed to carry a gun if they want. And those are not policies that are polling very well right now at all. Does that concern you at all going into this election?
I can tell you what's not polling very well, and that's Joe Biden, and that's the Michigan Democrat agenda. And I think this election is going to be about the kitchen table issues that are really impacting Michiganders, most at home here right now. And that's that groceries are taking up a larger percentage of people's incomes than at any time before. And, you know, the price of gas continues to go up. But it's more than that. It's our energy bills, which are, a direct consequence to the disastrous energy policy that Michigan Democrats ran through. It's a fentanyl crisis that is, you know, striking here at home in Michigan, but it's worsened by the open border policies of the Biden administration. And Michiganders are feeling that here at home.
But you would rather have Nikki Haley at the top of the ticket than Donald Trump, because you have to admit that Donald Trump repels some people. He repels some independents. He actually repels some Republicans. And if you would have Nikki Haley at the top of the ticket, maybe you would have a better shot at getting those independents and focusing on those issues as opposed to Donald Trump's baggage.
No, Kyle, you know, I would disagree with that. I think, this is going to be a race about Joe Biden versus Donald Trump. And I think most people would acknowledge that they were better off under the presidency of Donald Trump, and they had more money in their pocketbooks. Their savings weren't being eroded by the high cost of living, high inflation presidency of Joe Biden. And I tell you what, too, we talk about 10 different seats that Donald Trump carried when he was at the top of the ticket. And you look at the current polling right now that has, you know, Trump up on Biden. People in Michigan are not happy with the failed, feeble presidency of Joe Biden.
If I could, just one more thing, Samantha, I wanted to touch on, and that is, I was looking at the Wall Street Journal this past week, and it has a story on how Joe Biden has a massive campaign cash lead over Trump as the general election begins. That's out of the Wall Street Journal, and that was their words, a massive campaign cash advantage. And a lot of the issues is that Nikki Haley, for example, raised more money than the RNC did in the month of February. And that Donald Trump is having to spend a lot of the money that he is raising on his own legal bills, and leaving Republicans nationally a little nervous about if he's going to be able to compete with Democrats on the fundraising front. How concerned are you on that?
Well, I don't think, money can cloak the weak and feeble presidency of Joe Biden. You know, Kyle, he came to Saginaw last week, and you wouldn't have even noticed that the president of the United States visited the Great Lakes Bay region. He came and visited two households in Saginaw. He did, you know, no press statements, no rally, no conference. You know, I was talking to my mom, and she's not as dialed in to politics as two other guys named Bill Schuette, and she said, "You're telling me the president actually visited Saginaw this last week?" And that's incredible. You know, and that type of basement presidency campaigning aspect, that's not going to resonate with voters. I don't care how much money you have.
I'm curious, how does the HRCC work when it comes to supporting candidates in the Republican caucus for the general election? If it is a candidate like someone like Josh Shriver, who has recently been condemned by Democrats and Republicans alike for his comments related to the replacement theory, would you, if he were to be up for re-election, makes it through his primary going into November, would the HRCC be obligated to support his campaign?
So the House Republican Campaign Committee is focused on beating Democrats and taking back the majority, starting at 56 seats and going from there. And, you know, if you look at the most competitive seats across our state, those are going to be the ones where House Republicans are playing and where we're going to go on offense and where we're going to win. Those are, as we talked about earlier, those are the seats that Donald Trump carried in 2016 and in 2020, and it's protecting our incumbents as well. I don't think in Merz's handicapping of lists, you get down to the Oxford area as a seat that's competitive.
You never know, but the Democrats, to Samantha's point, could use Josh Shriver against your caucus in some of these elections as standing with Josh Shriver and white supremacy. That could be a slogan that they use on you all.
Kyle, this election is going to, again, be about these cost of living issues, the kitchen table issues that matter most to Michiganders. That's and Democrats are going to try to distract on this issue or that. But the fact is people in Michigan, their savings are being eroded by Joe Biden's economy. Their energy bills are going to be more expensive because of the disastrous Michigan Democrat energy legislation. And again, you know, here in Midland County, I hear from our local sheriff about how the opioid epidemic and the fentanyl crisis is just completely worsened by the disastrous southern border that's the consequence of the Joe Biden administration.
But still, just to confirm, and I think I remember almost even wondering, is Oxford, could it have gone blue? Could it have been become more of a purple district following the Oxford High School shooting? You kind of saw some advocates on the ground there that really liked some of the gun policy proposals that Democrats are putting on the table. And there's been a lot of questions about that area. And I think suburban Oakland County is something we always have questions about. I mean, if that district did become competitive, though, and Josh Shriver was running for re-election for that November race, would the HRCC still have to finance that?
Sam, I love that you guys like to dwell on hypotheticals. I'm dealing with the here and now and the reality. And the reality is that House Republicans are focused on taking back the majority, on beating Democrats. And there's going to be a lot of very highly competitive seats that we've discussed. And I know that, you know, there will be distractions this way and that way. But the issues that this election boils down to are those issues where Republicans are going to go and win.
In talking with your dad, who's obviously been in politics for a long time, has he mentioned that this cycle, it seems like it's more nationalized than ever, that the issues that people are interested in really fall at a national level more than in the past? Or are we just noticing it more and it's always kind of been that way?
Kyle, you'll get a kick out of this. I told, you know, dad the news about being named HRCC chair, and he said, well, congratulations. Now, don't screw it up or our state is screwed. And I said, well, gee, thanks, Dad. I love you, too. You know, and I think that, you know, we can see national issues trickling down to our state level politics. But I think that's to be expected. And I think that that's because the consequences of something like a disastrous border policy have impacts in Lee Township in Midland County. That it's because high cost of living, high inflation economy is going to hurt people from Monroe to Marquette. And that's the reality that we're living in.
Does the topic of fentanyl, though, does policy proposals, do they have to also be tie-barred to immigration subjects? Or is there a way that you could just zoom in on fentanyl without touching the immigration issue?
Well, you know, so Sam, I worked as an intelligence officer with the Department of Defense, and I was specifically focused on counter drug issues. And I was sent down to Mexico for a period of about 4 months in when I worked there. And I've seen firsthand that you can't separate the issue from the southern border from fentanyl because, you know, fentanyl, a synthetic opioid that's more than 50 times stronger than heroin, is being flooded into this country by the cartels and coming through our southern border. So you can't separate the two issues. And, you know, when you have members of the Democrat caucus who have called for defunding ICE, when you have those who would like to institute sanctuary cities in Michigan, those are real issues. And those resonate here at home. And we've seen how damaging that can be in Michigan.
I don't think I know this. How old are you, Rep. Schutte?
I'm 28 years old.
Okay, I'm 26. What is your dream job?
You know, I think my dream job, I don't think I want to take the job of being head coach of the Detroit Lions away from Dan Campbell, but I'm just focused on, doing the job that I was elected to in the 95th district. And Coach Campbell is doing a pretty good job with the Lions right now. So I'll let him keep that job.
What about state Senate? You think state senator sounds good? There could be an opening sometime soon.
Well, you know, again, something I like to tell my dad is, you know, he likes to say he got elected to Congress. He was the youngest member of Congress when he was elected. And I said, you know, Dad, you're 71 now. You still haven't made it to the state house.
When we were talking, when we had pundits on to talk about the 8th Congressional District, when Dan Kildee's retirement announced, it was said that one of the Schutte's is going to run. It's either going to be the father or the son, but maybe one of them might drop their hats in that race. Why did you and your dad decide not to get involved?
Well, I'm sure Dad would love to come on the podcast sometime if you want to ask about his decision. The reason I decided to run for re-election was really about the topic we've been discussing today, the need and the importance of taking back the state house. You know, if I had chosen to run for Congress, I'm confident I would have won. But, you know, if we don't take back our state house, Sam, Michigan is going to be out of luck, because we've seen the consequences and the damaging impacts of a Democrat trifecta in Lansing. And that's been all the issues we've talked about, of a higher cost of living and, energy bills going through the roof. And that's why I'm, focused on making sure we take back the majority in this next election.
But in the 8th Congressional District, though, I mean, why do you think not more Republicans wanted to get engaged in that race? Why does it only really seem like you have Paul Young and that's about it?
Oh, Nikki Snyder moved today. You're taping on Friday, and Nikki Snyder just announced she's dropping U.S. Senate. She's running for that 8th Congressional District seat.
Yeah, there you go. And then I think you might see filing deadline is still a little bit more than a month away. So you might see other candidates get involved in the race too. And that's going to be one of the most competitive races in the country. And whoever is the Republican nominee in that seat, I'll be working hard to help get elected to that congressional seat, because it's important that we retain our Republican majority in Congress as well.
All right. So I got to ask the big question. Let's get the projection out. Bill Schutte, how many seats will the Republicans win in the state house in 2024?
North of 56, 56 and up. So there you go.
That's not
relentlessly on message. Hey, all I know is that Republicans are going to be in control of the house. And, I've learned that you got to keep the main thing. We're going to return our incumbents, and we're going to take back the majority. And that's my focus. Kyle, I don't want to, cut into your market share at MERS. Nobody does handicapping better than you guys. I'm sure you'll be able to divvy up that prediction yourself.
Before we conclude, obviously, you know, Rep. Schutte, that we have songs that follow our segments.
Oh,
What song do you want to be the outro song for today?
Oh, man, Sam, that's a tough question. Maybe I'm a huge American history fan, and I love the musical Hamilton. So I'm not throwing away my shot, this opportunity as HRCC chair here.
Okay, I will. I got you. Now, everybody, that is State Representative Bill Schutte, a Midland Republican, and again, the latest chair of the House Republican Campaign Committee. Thank you for joining us on the MERS Monday podcast.
Thanks, Sam. Thanks, Kyle. Kyle, hope you have a good run this weekend.
Thanks. I hope I don't have to wear my yak tracks.
Now, that is going to do it for this week's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. But before we conclude things here, we are going to talk very briefly about the polling we referenced during our conversation with Republican U.S. Senate candidate Mike Rogers. Kyle, can you tell us about this polling and kind of the whole why, what, when of it all?
Well, thanks, Sam. Yeah, we talked with Mitchell Research and Communications about doing polling in the U.S. Senate race and what kind of impact the Trump endorsement had. And we referenced it in our interview with Mike Rogers. And what we found is that before people were told that Donald Trump had endorsed Mike Rogers, he was leading the field with 27%. But then when we told folks that he had got the endorsement, the numbers went completely haywire. Rogers shot up 40% to 40 percentage points to 67%. Peter Meyer was at 5%. Justin Amash was at 5%. Sandy Pensler was only at 1%. And the undecideds dropped considerably from 57% to 20%.
What was the sample size of this?
It was a smaller sample size. It was 277 people. So it's not an enormous poll, but it does show you that the Trump endorsement had a, as Steve Mitchell put it, an unbelievable impact on this race. And I know that Rogers went as far as to say in our podcast that it puts the race out of reach and it's pretty much over. And honestly, if, you know, barring something outrageous or unforeseen coming out, I don't know how he can be wrong. Now that he's got James Craig on his side, he's got the DC folks on his side, it seems to me that he's got the tailwind, and there's really nobody who's got the resources and the organization to really combat that. I mean, you could say that Justin Amash has a national following, but he doesn't have a lot of money. Sandy Pentzler has the money, but not a lot of following. You've got this this Glenn Wilson guy who's got a little bit of money, but not Sandy Pentzler money. And so then what you got left then is Peter Meyer, really. And Peter Meyer has a little bit of money, but he's also got a lot of negative name ID from voting for the Trump impeachment. So unless he wants to spend some money, you know, that could move things a little bit, but there just doesn't seem to be a real strong path for an anti-Trump candidate in this particular year. I mean, maybe at some point Peter Meyer is able to connect, but this just doesn't seem like the year. It doesn't seem like Republican voters are really interested in the type of intellectual arguments that Peter Meyer could bring. They're more just interested in following the herd and following Donald Trump and just looking the other way or making excuses for whatever legal trouble he happens to be in.
This less than 300 sample, is that specifically likely GOP primary voters?
Yes, it is.
Now, I know that you also looked into the Democratic primary, where Alyssa Slotkin, the current congresswoman, is pretty much, do I dare say, obviously, is that an appropriate adjective, that she is leading currently? I believe it is, has a lead over Hill Harper, 57 to 11%, while business executive Nasser Baydoun is at 3%. Is that the same kind of range of voters, or like less than 300 likely Democratic primary voters?
Yeah, it is. And it is a wider margin of error. Now we're talking a margin of error around 7%, which if this were a close race, it would make an impact. But it's not a close race at all. And, you know, while Slotkin has in this race 57%, you could say, well, because of the margin of error, she's really at 50%. Or you could say she's at 64%. And either way, it doesn't really matter because she's over 50% or at 50% or more in a multi-candidate field. So she's leading and winning regardless. It's kind of the same thing here with Hill Harper. I mean, he's really swimming upstream in that he has very little name ID. The Democratic apparatus has all pretty much coalesced around Alyssa Slotkin. They're eyeing the next thing. They're eyeing the general election. They're basically trying to skip the primary and just go right into it because they don't want to waste a lot of resources going toe-to-toe with somebody who's to the left of Alyssa Slotkin.
Now, obviously, the legislature is gone on spring break. We are legislative reporters. That's why I want to point it out. They are going to be gone throughout this week, which is the final week of March, and throughout the first week of April. Kyle, how big of a story is the U.S. Senate race? I mean, is this a big enough story that you're going to be majorly focused on this while the legislature is out of town as we kind of enter the slow spring? Or is this story, do I dare say, to kind of echo what Mike Rogers said, is it kind of a settled story because we have Mike Rogers in the lead, Alyssa Slotkin in the lead of her respective primary? Is this worth covering from the reporter perspective?
I think what's the most interesting, I guess, for us is who's going to just end up making the ballot. I think really that's what we're going to be looking at, because as of right now, I don't see any candidate making a move on Mike Rogers between now and the filing deadline. May, June, July, maybe it's a different story. Maybe Sandy Pentzler opens up his checkbook. Maybe this Glenn Wilson guy has a lot of bucks. But up until then, I don't think we're going to see a lot of spend on that. So just taking a look at the field with Nikki Snyder dropping out and deciding that she was going to run for a district that she actually doesn't even live in. She sees her prospects better running in a district that's not where she currently lives. We'll have 12 candidates remaining in the Republican primary. And I would project that we'll have fewer than half of these folks actually make the ballot. You know, you have folks like J.D. Wilson, Sharon Savage, Alexandria Taylor, this Benson Samuel guy. I just don't see how they have the wherewithal to gather the 15,000 signatures they need to make the ballot. That is not a small task. 1,000 signatures is for Congress. This is 15,000. I just don't know how they're doing that. I don't know if they're not reporting a ton of money. I don't know how they can pay for it. And I just don't know that they have the organization to pull it off. And then you've got the higher profile folks like Justin Amash and Rebecca Curran. They got in so late. I just don't know how they're going to gather the signatures either. You know, they both got in about 50 days before the filing deadline, which if you do the math and you figure, okay, to get a cushion, you should probably get at least 20,000. That has them gathering 400 signatures a day, every day for the duration of the time they announced to the filing deadline. Now, I don't know. I know Justin Amash has a great Twitter following, but I don't know if he's got people who are gathering 100 signatures for him a day or 50 signatures for him a day. And where would these people be? Does he have money to help get this together and hire some circulators? I'm not aware that he does. And then this, I understand this Rebecca Curran has some background in politics, but likewise, I just don't know if she has the network to pull it off. So my prediction is that outside of Rogers, Michael Hoover is going to get in. Dr. Sherry O'Donnell, she's turning in her signatures today. We're taping on Monday. She's turning her signatures in, so she'll get in. But outside of that, does Sandy Pensler go through with it? His name ID is just so low. His last ad didn't really connect. I'm not convinced that, you know, somebody who's as successful as he is, whether he sees it of value to spend his personal wealth on a race like this, where he's such a long shot. I mean, Mike Rogers, 67%, and Pensler has 1%. God, does he really go through with it? Does Peter Meyer go through with it? Until we see something otherwise, I think the story, Sam, is who actually wants to be on the ballot with Mike Rogers just so they can get beat.
Well, thank you so much for that commentary, Kyle. I really appreciate it. Now it's time to thank our numerous guests who came on this week, starting with the Republican U.S. Senate candidate, Mike Rogers. We recorded that interview this morning. Chief Executive Director Cheryl Bergman of the Michigan's Women's Commission, which we recorded on Friday. And thank you to State Representative Bill G. Schuette, a Midland Republican, for joining us near the end of today's episode. And as promised, I will be wrapping up this episode with the Hamilton musical song he requested. We did that interview with Bill G. Schuette on Friday. Oh, so I would like to express my substantial gratitude to MERS editor Kyle Malin, publisher John Rurink, the boss, and our administrative reporter, Andrew Miniker, for joining me on this episode. Thank you to Mark Bayshore of Mark Bayshore Audio and Okemos, which puts this audio together and puts the formal edits on our segments. Until next time, I am your host, Samantha Schreiber.
Let's get this guy in front of a crowd. I am not throwing away my shot. Hey, I'm just like my country, I'm young, scrappy, and hard.